Saga's return for their fourth main set appearance, and it seems that Kamigawa Neon Dynasty, not content with reinventing just an entire plane, is also pushing the boundaries of Saga design. So, what new features are in store for us, and are Sagas still the supreme way to tell stories? Welcome to Magic the Flavouring, the Magic the Gathering podcast, where we talk about all things magic flavour design and lore. I'm your host, Andy Mann.
Hello, this is Nathan Cancel.
Episode 99. 99 episodes.
Last of the double digits.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Didn't seem that long ago that we were saying like, oh, you know, when we get to episode 100, kind of mockingly, and now we're here. And it doesn't feel like
it. It doesn't seem that long ago since we were at your work in Bunga Bunga. Being like, oh yeah, like we'll definitely do this podcasting. And then our mutual friend Luke Allen was like, is that going to happen? Is that a thing? We're like, sure. Yeah. And then like a week later, like I actually bought the mic, like because we were just using my Yeti when we were still recording in person, which we only got up to like 20 episodes or something recording in person or something stupid before COVID hit. Yeah, it's been wild. It's been like 2 years.
I know, a lot of stuff's happened. Magic's a very different beast now than it was 2 years ago. Like I feel the momentum of this is kind of interesting for this episode, right? I feel like the modern era, as it were, is on our shoulders, and there's been a bit of progress to get it. We've had to fight through some battles to get it. But I feel like the modern age is definitely in full swing. As I said, I literally had this bullshit arrive today. These lovely sexy. Monster hunt. What were they called? Monster movie marathon.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, did you not? And you're not looking at the camera. Like we have the camera set up for a reason, Andy.
Yeah. What are? Oh, right. So your secret lair. Yes. The secret lair, which are like the right. This is terrible podcasting, by the way. 99 episodes, and we're awful. So hello everyone listening. By the way, sorry. Nathan's just shown me over the camera that we're recording on. His secret lair has just shown up. And we're not talking about secret lairs today. And we'll pontificate more about our journey on podcasting when we reach episode 100 in a couple of weeks' time, or maybe slightly less, depending on our recording schedule. Today we are going to be talking about the Kamigawa sagas. Sagas are back, baby. It continues.
It does. They're here to stay. Clearly, they are a story device that wizards are willing to continue with. And also with throwback sets. Isn't it kind of like dumb not to use this as an opportunity of what stories from back in the day were told and what ones are being... This is the perfect set for it, right?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, but we say that every time they use them.
That's so, because they're great. They're malleable. Awesome. You can use them in so many different ways, even though you use them almost in the exact same way every time.
Well, sort of. So the reason we're talking about this today in its own episode is because we did do our Flavor Picks episode last week, or however long ago the last episode was. And it would have just been way too easy to just stick sagas as all five of our flavor picks, each of us. Do you know what I mean? It could have been our honorable mention. It could have been any of the top ones. It could have been whatever. We could have done the whole episode on it. So I think we both elected to, almost without saying, I think we both were like, yeah, we're going to do sagas as their own thing. We can't put them in the flavor picks episode because that's just boring. Because they're all the flavor picks. Like, and I think even last week you were saying the whole set is a flavor pick. But yeah, sagas have, they've only appeared in four sets.
Well, five if we count Urza's Saga.
No.
Oh, so four then. Nice, good.
Like, yes, that's all right. Urza's Saga.
Get out of here, Urza. No one cares about you.
Urza's Saga, yes, was in Modern Horizons 2. So yes, Urza's Saga does count as a fifth set, I suppose. But as an actual mechanic that was built around or used as a part of the set en masse. They've only been in four mainline sets, right?
Yes.
Standard legal sets. Which is crazy, considering how much of an impact they've had on the game. And not just in the Commander format, but just as a piece of game design across all of Magic. Like, it's wild. It's really wild. I mean, the fact also that they came in Dominaria was the first set where we used sagas. And then they didn't reappear until Kaldheim. Until Theros Beyond Death. Like, that's a huge amount of time. And I know we've done episodes on sagas before, and I know that we've spoken about them quite a bit, because they are effectively the most flavorful of all card design. But the reason we're running it back with the Sagas Kamigawa is because they've amped it up again. They've done it again. They've pushed the boat. Dudes, these sagas flip. There's two-faced sagas people in the world.
Right?
What's going on? What's happened?
I guess it's, what's interesting, right, is that this is a very, very, because that's the point. Every single one of these sagas does the exact same format, right, of where it has three chapters, and on the third chapter, they exile themselves and they return transformed.
Yeah.
And you could argue to a degree that kind of it takes away some nuance of mechanical flavor, because the third ability is just always the same ability. But you'd be wrong, because not only does it also does it have its own flavor, and we'll talk about this in a little bit. Does the flipping have its own flavor? The thing on the other side having its own almost chapter. It's also then got the opportunity for flavor text. You're able to do something of like a before and after. So this is the story. This is the story that's being told, and then this is how it manifests in the modern world. Like it's. I mean, obviously, this sounds stupid to say. Oh, put extra text on the other side of the card and it gives the card more well, obviously it's twice the card, and this is why we've always quite liked this idea of cards that flip and tell a story as they do so. But this is like taking something that already has a bunch of story and then adding that quality to it. It's crazy. Yeah it's crazy.
Yeah, for sure. And also it's the perfect callback to OG Kamigawa as well, which I don't think people really appreciate, is the fact that in OG Kamigawa you had, I mean, we call these flip cards because we physically flip them over, but they are modal double-faced cards is what Watsy really wants us to call these things. Or double-faced cards, that's the thing they kept pushing over the past year of card design. But the flip cards, as we've discussed many times before, are the OG Kamigawa cards, which are, it's one face, but you spin them around on the table, so like they have two like name boxes and all that kind of thing. So the fact that they've brought the flip mechanic back and put it into Kamigawa so naturally, just as part of modern card design, is also just a really cool callback to the fact that flip cards were the thing in OG Kamigawa, and this is like the kind of more refined version of all of that kind of way of thinking. They're just beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. I was looking at the number of sagas per set that they've appeared in. Off the top of your head, Nathan, what do you think out of Dominaria, Theros Beyond Death, Kaldheim, Neon Genesis, Kamigawa Land.
What, Evangelion?
Yeah, well, I don't know why I couldn't think of the name of the set. Which one has the least amount of sagas, do you think?
Probably Dominaria, right?
Nope. You had it on the tip of your tongue there. You almost said Theros, which you've been
I was going to go Theros, yeah.
Dominaria. Theros Beyond Death had 10 sagas. Dominaria had 14.
Okay.
Kaldheim had 20.
Yeah.
How many does...
That was the two cycles, right? Because it was the uncommon cycle and the rare cycle, and they were both multicolored. Well, I know that there's a bunch of white ones, so I'm going to assume they've got an uptick by what? Probably about 25% again. So there's probably be about 25 of them.
Oh, you've overshot. 23, I have it.
Okay. Okay. But still, it's still like...
And then Modern Horizons 2 had more, right? Yeah, still more and more. That's only interesting to me because you'd have thought Kaldheim, being the set of sagas and storytelling, like would have the most amount. Like it's quite incredible actually how many sagas are in Kamigawa. Like I just didn't twig it until I pulled up the Scryfall page today to have a little look at it.
But I guess the argument is right that just because Kaldheim is this plane of stories doesn't mean that Kamigawa doesn't have more stories to tell.
Yeah, that's true.
And I guess
how ancient some of these planes are.
Yeah, I guess, because the thing is, I guess they kind of needed to define each individual realm's history, right? And they kind of could do that across two, and that's how it worked. With some of them are a little bit more nebulous, but I think for most of them it was kind of like this is the way we explain and give some history to each of the realms without having, you know, the opportunity to otherwise go too far into them. You know, you've got 10 realms. Here's a little drive-by blurb about them, and they just chucked down a saga, and it kind of worked for that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the flavor is just incredible. Like, just to bring it back, I mean, as people can probably tell, this is a relatively loose episode, only because there's so much going on. The fact that they've just decided to split the story of all these sagas across not just the ancient history of Kamigawa, but also like its more modern facets as well, is just pretty amazing. The fact that the thing that it flips into is always an enchantment creature as well. Mm-hmm. We're not just flipping into like another like sort of saga-esque mode, or like say even just one or other. Like it doesn't just flip into a creature or an enchantment. the fact that they are all enchantment creatures is a significant design choice, because it really tells the story of Kamigawa and how Kamigawa approaches its own history as well. Like, there's lots of motifs throughout all of the Kamigawa sets, like old and new, about things like living lore and living history. Like, you see that kind of motif in a lot of the names of the legendary creatures, or in a lot of the artwork, you know, where the characters like Reki, tattoo themselves, or if they have like their dress is invoked with like the lore, the written lore of Kamigawa. And so to have representations of the lore act also as physical entities unto themselves is a very Kami-esque, very Kamigawa approach to their history. And I think it's an absolute perfect design. You couldn't have done that, for example, with Kaldheim. Like, as much as, like, you maybe could have had, like, some sort of, like, mythical creature. Or, like, Theros, for example. There's obviously enchantment creatures in Theros, because they're all Nyxborn. But I think you would have struggled to have found the flavor of having an enchantment creature on the back of all of the sagas from Theros, for example.
Yeah, I think that's a very good distinction. It's funny that in a set where there were a bunch of enchantment creatures, because I feel like that's, a difficult, like, thing to define. Like, what makes an enchantment creature an enchantment? Because obviously there are a bunch of creatures that have like static effects, right? Like a good example of these were like the archetypes from Theros, of where they weren't just, it wasn't just a boar, right? It wasn't just like a bestowed upon kind of thing, of where not only am I an elk, but I could also be like, you know, a totem elk kind of shield around you kind of thing. Like, fair enough, that makes sense of how bestow works. Whereas you had other ones like, say, the archetype of endurance, of where it gives all of your stuff an effect and takes an effect away from your opponent, almost has like a residual effect beyond its creatureness. Whereas it feels like it's slightly different in Kamigawa. Like, it's not that these are like, have like a slight different essence to them. It's really hard to define. I'd like to see kind of a conversation of kind of how they handle, like, from a lore perspective, what makes a creature an enchantment? Where is the line between being an enchantment and just an enchantment creature? And where's the line between a creature and a creature enchantment? Because you could argue a lot of the legends from original Kamigawa had these kind of weird abilities, right? Which would feel like enchantment effects if they weren't also printed with power and toughness, which is kind of, I guess, what they're going for here. But I think the other thing that with these sagas specifically is that the creature itself is spawned from the lore. The only way that this creature exists is from the lore that came before it. And that lore is the effect of that enchantment, that the story and the weight it carries and the magic that it carries with it, right? Like, words have meaning and have power and strength within the world of magic, as we can see. We've gone to 4/5 different planes and seen how the stories have gravitas and have effects and have their own magic. So it's quite nice to see in Kamigawa then manifest into living things that you can then, you know, interact with, or can, they're very different, various different swings on it throughout these different sagas as well. It's not all just the same thing of where, oh, story manifest. Sometimes it's the, oh no, but like, you know, maybe there's the shade of this legendary still around, or maybe it's the anger of a legendary creature manifested and it has its own life and its own whim, or maybe it's even something simple as a kami that's passed over, you know, from the spirit realm because of what's happened.
So there's some very good examples of this, like, say, of the kind of spread. So if you have let's look at some specific sagas now. So you have something like the Modern Age, which is a blue saga, a common saga. Its first two modes are draw a card and then discard a card. Its third mode is exile, and then it comes back. On the backside, it comes in as Vector Glider, which is a spirit enchantment creature with flying 2/3. And the flavor text literally is, it drifted from the spirit realm into a neon world full of new possibilities and decided to stay. So as we know from from the kami from Kamigawa, much like, I guess, the gods of Nyx in Theros, a lot of their roles on the plane are dictated by maybe the manifestations of everyday life, or perhaps it's everyday life that's informed by their manifestation. Like, it's a very sort of symbiotic relationship. So the fact that you have this Vector Glider spirit who is effectively like a kami, but like a neon kami, because of the modern world, it's come into the physical and gone, oh yeah, this is where I'm meant to be. This kind of idea that perhaps if it came into Kamigawa 1,200 years ago, it would have pissed off back to the spirit realm. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's this really nice idea. So that's a very literal idea of, like, it turns into the modern form of a kami. But then you have something like Life of Toshiro Umezawa, which of course tells the life of Toshiro Umezawa. Beautiful art as well. We'll talk about a bit about the art, but this Sumi-e ink painting is like fucking great. And then the life of Toshiro Mizawa comes back in as memory of Toshiro. Still a 2-3 human samurai, but the actual idea of it is it's the memory of this character that's being invoked. And the flavor text is, some called him a hero of the Kami War, others a selfish thief. As ever, the truth is hidden somewhere in between. No mention of this thing being actually a physical manifestation of memory of Toshiro, but because of the lore that we understand it, we can, as mages, I guess, or playing the game of Magic the Gathering, manifest the memory of Toshiro into existence. I mean, it's just so playful. Like, it's absolutely fantastic. What are the sagas that kind of break out to you, that if you have to have a look through? What's the ones that, for whatever reason, like artwork, mechanic, story?
So I really liked, and this is another thing we haven't said, that all of the, not all of them, but 10 of the sagas that are listed here also got their own little, like, story article blurby kind of things.
Yes, as well they did, yeah.
As much as these are kind of like a history of the plane to, like, even in the metaverse, telling the story to the generations after, within the plane of Kamigawa, they're also reminders to the players of the stories and the legends from the original Kamigawa block. And for those that weren't around, we got some little story blurbs of things like the little drive-by of the Kami War and what happened and how it was all caused. It was a good way for the modern audience to get caught up, and then also on the cards kind of have the modern audience get caught up whilst the plane's also catching itself up. I liked the Shattered States era. I liked this idea of, I didn't really know this aspect, this story, and I love the idea that the art, that the story is being told on the hilt of a katana. Because it's something we talked about a lot during Kaldheim, of where we don't just want to see the story, even on a tapestry isn't necessarily the most exciting. Like, and this kind of is epitomized in the Kamigawa, where it shows various different forms of how we tell stories. Right, there's urns in some of them. There's as I say, reliefs on sword hilts. There's quite clearly like paintings as well as like artwork on a fat. Like, there's loads of different forms that it's come in. And I don't think any of them are the real texture like we got in Kaldheim, like the carving, for example, that everyone obviously lost their minds about by Victor Adame Minguez. I don't think we had any of that in this, but it looks like they very pushed.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it's a weird one. Obviously, all cultures have things like actual sculptures, and like, you know, every kind of ancient culture has, like, say, like a tattoo heritage or like a weaving heritage or whatever else. But what I sense from a lot of Japanese artistry is that it's a lot of prints and imagery put onto physical objects. So I suppose that you could have had an artist say, create an actual ukiyo-e like print block and actually, you know, use that layering technique, but that's like incredibly extensive and also incredibly you need to be an expert at that kind of wood print. You can't just knock that out. But even something like the fan art, like Japanese folding fans were invented in Japan and, you know, are a big part of Japanese culture, not just as part of art, but also like samurai were said to use them as like weaponry in warfare. So, you know, they're a huge part of the aesthetic of what people understand as Japan. And obviously on where's the saga which has the fan print on it? Michiko's Reign of Truth. We get the image of a depiction of a folding fan with the Michiko Kondor art on the fan itself, which is something that you would do. But I think it would be a lot to ask, for example, an artist, especially like you know, mainstay artists like Titus Lunter or Volkenberger for Michiko's Reign of Truth, to get a folding fan and then do the art on the folding fan. Like, I think that's maybe a step too far. Like, it was nice that we got a carving because that's something that Victor Damirengas wanted to do. But I don't know if you could do that for every set. We were spoiled by Kaldheim. Do you know what
I mean? That's the thing, right? Yeah, you get given something that's like above and beyond, and then everyone's like, but why can't we always have that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, why did you give us something and then only to give us a little taste? I guess it's also interesting is the symbols changed, right, as well. The symbol in the top left-hand corner.
Oh,
is it a closed fan into open fan? Is that what it's supposed to be representing?
Yes.
I don't think I've seen it mentioned anywhere else. It looks like
Do you know what? I don't know if I've... Well, that's. It's only changed because I suppose the arrows aren't necessarily... because you're not... Oh, I don't know. Is it because maybe it's trying to tell you... Whereas things like the lands, you know, the lands that could come in at one side or the other, I suppose they both look the same on either side. Whereas these are very, like, the framing is different Do you know what I mean?
I guess it's the first time we've had a... Because it's only... These symbols only get put on the MDFCs, right? To kind of show you this is the side it's supposed to be on and this is the side that happens after a while, right? But it's just... It's kind of... I just like the fact they went for a fan motif out of
well,
everything.
Well, I suppose Innistrad has always
understated
done that.
Almost. Yeah, well, cause, and then yeah. I guess they swapped right for Eldritch Moonif where they had the Emrakuli kind of symbol, right?
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Nice. Like, Innistrad, for their MDFCs, have always had the different symbols. I think it's just we've gotten used to recent sets having the arrows, the up arrow and the up down arrow, whatever it is. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's just a little tiny thing, right? But that's what I quite like. And the only thing... So my only main criticism against... and I kind of mentioned this earlier when I was talking about how mechanically, flavor-wise, having all of them do this the thing... on their third chapter of Exile and Return, it is kind of that's not there. It might as well just be that the other side of the card is there. The other thing that kind of I feel like is that the abilities on the cards aren't quite as nuanced. I feel like that they kind of pushed the nuance on Kaldheim to a point of where it was kind of a chore to read them. You know, like it was kind of almost a bore to read them. Like it felt like the cards did something very much more specific and. An individual, whereas I feel like the effects on the Kamigawa ones are slightly more generic, which isn't a bad thing whatsoever, because I feel like a lot of the flavor comes from the eventual story on the backside, not necessarily like the stages you have to get through to get to the front side, or to get through the front side. Like Life of Toshiro Mizawa, for example, has the first two chapters a choice of one of the three effects that you had on his Jite, right? Of either to give a creature +2/+2, give a creature -1/-1, or gain 2 life. And then on the flip side, it flips into a 2/3 that you can tap and pay 1 life, add a black, but only use that to cast an instant or sorcery. Harkens back to his legendary card where you can cast one instant or sorcery from your graveyard per turn. I think it's a black instant or sorcery from your. Anyway, he has an interaction with instant sorceries in your graveyard, and obviously this can fuel that. So if you have a Toshiro deck, this is like flavor home run. Because the memory of Toshiro can help Toshiro from the past, so that works. I do find that there is a slight diminish on the effects on the front face that kind of then gets the added benefit on the reverse. Where I feel like the flavor's kind of back ended rather than front faced, if you know what I mean.
So I think that's definitely a gameplay design. That's a really interesting thing that you said. So I've got the page up with all of the sagas that have ever been printed. I'm just having a look through the Kaldheim ones now, and obviously Kaldheim had. The 10 realms, it had the 10 tribes, because it was also a tribal set that I think sometimes gets a little bit overlooked because each tribe was dedicated to a color pair, and obviously each color pair got then 2 sagas dedicated to it, so they were very targeted either to the tribe itself or maybe like the playstyle that, you know, is going on. Actually, I think I've slightly misremembered that there's more combinations of like sagas to the tribes, but whatever. So for example, like the Blood Sky Massacre is create a 2/3 red demon berserker creature token with menace, so that's like demon specific. You got Bears of Lityara has like shapeshifter synergies. Forging the Tyrite Sword is all treasures and equipment based, which, you know, for the red white dwarves was their whole kind of thing. So I think they did fit much more into the archetypes of play for specific paths in either draft or limited, or for commander, for example, if you want to build like your Narfi deck, you're going to want the Narfi, like, you know, saga. Whereas I think you're right, for the sagas for Kamigawa, I think they're just, because they're such a big part, they're 23 cards in a set. If you make them too specific to a set that isn't necessarily drawn so hard anymore on, say, tribes, because they're not really doing hard tribal in this set. Like there's like samurai synergy and like ninja synergy and ninjutsu, but you're not necessarily defined to go down those lines.
No.
I think they do have to make them more broad, but I think the flavor is there in all the rest of the presentation, like you say. Like Akiba Reckoner Raid, for example, which is for my money actually my favorite saga. I keep going on about the Nozumi in this set. I fucking love them.
They
I think
do look
great.
So cool. Yeah, that style is so fantastic.
This is such a good idea. It's such a good transition into a whole other genre of like what Kamigawa is, and they're still fulfilling the role that they're doing, but whilst being completely different. It's brilliant. Anyway, so Akiba Reckoner Raid, the first two modes of it are each opponent loses 1 life and you gain 1 life. That's not a rat synergy or an injured synergy or even really a Reckoner synergy. That's just what black does, right? Which is fairly broad. But then on the backside with Nozumi Road Captain, it has itself is a rat rogue with 2/2 with menace. And then vehicles you control have menace. So it kind of fulfills everything that you want to do. Like you, and because it only costs 1 mana, you could stick it down if you're just doing kind of generic black stuff and be like, yep, for two turns I get to have this effect and then I get a creature out of it. But then also if you're going heavily into the, like the Nozumi or black vehicle strategy, the flip side also has that super flavorful thing as well. And I just think, yet again, they've got these sagas and they have room to play with form and function that works on almost every level that you want it to work on as a Magic player. Also, as a side note for Nozumi Road Captain, we were talking earlier about how the representations of what the enchantment creature actually is can be quite broad. This to me is just absolutely hilarious. The fact that this isn't like some kind of ancient carving or like the sort of manifestation of a memory of like some ancient hero. This is literally some dude's graffiti jacket and the graffiti mural on the back of the jacket is the enchantment creature because it's evoking exactly what the Nozumi are all about, to the point where it's like their banner, it's their symbol, it is who they are, and so it's that manifestation, you know, united by the by defiant pride in their outsider status. The Nozumi of the Akiba Reckoners boast the most advanced cyber bikes and the best riders of all the Reckoner gangs. Like, come on, man. Again, Victor Adame Mingus is absolutely on fire in the past few sets, man. But yeah.
Yeah, I like to brilliant. Think that the guy in that artwork on the front, like, it's almost the opposite. The coat's telling the story, but he is the road captain on top, and he's only the road
captain. Oh, interesting. Oh, that's a cool idea.
You know what I mean?
Idea.
It's almost like the reverse-y of it. I mean, I guess, like, there's also, from a design point of view, they very much, the way they balanced out having both equipment, like heavy equipment theme, and then also a heavy enchantment theme, because that was kind of the way they did. They had an artifact, a heavy artifact theme and a heavy enchantment theme, is that they made half of the artifacts vehicles, so they can go, they're not artifacts and they can become creatures, and then all of the equipment can reconfigure into creatures, and then all of these enchantment sagas, because you need your enchantment synergies, they also then flip into creatures as well. And it kind of, as much as it kind of then makes everything feel like, oh well, I guess everything's just a creature, they're like, well yeah, but kind of almost in their own ways, and the fact that you have them all side by side almost creates more of a diversity of flavor than a everything's also a creature kind of thing. Like, it's funny how they do it in different ways and that kind of still give them all mechanical like individual identity. And again, I'd love this idea of where the story is being told for years and years and years, and it's got such gravitas that it then, as we've said, manifests into this different creature. And it's not always the exact same way. Sometimes it's almost like bringing it back. Like, so one of my favorite ones is Behold the Unspeakable, mostly because when I was younger, let me find the trio of cards. I think it was Peer Through Depths, Reach Through Mists, and Sift Through Sands. Oh, we remembered them off the top of his head. Look at that. Basically, there were three arcane spells. If you happened to play all three of them within the same turn, you would be able to get search your library for a card, the Unspeakable, and it's like a 6/5 flying trample or something. And, you know, it's cool effect. I love the idea that you could use these different pieces to kind of then go and cheat it out. And it was almost like the Saratami were like almost like kind of delving into Eldritch. It was almost like the Eldritch horror kind of thing before Innistrad kind of coined that and kind of took it for its own. And I like the idea that on the flip side of Behold the Unspeakable, it's the Vision of the Unspeakable, which is a flying trample 0/0 gets +1/+1 for each card in your hand. Obviously the front side does things that, you know, increase your hand size, and the whole point was with, even if you play all of this in an Unspeakable deck, all of the Peer Through Depths, Sift Through Sands, they're all like card selection and card draw effects as well. So it all kind of plays to itself. And it's not that the Unspeakable's back. No, it's that you have a vision of the Unspeakable. It's almost like you have to go on like almost like a vision quest kind of thing. And I just love this idea because this was one of the biggest, like, was almost like a little quest when I first was opening cards. Because I never opened the Unspeakable. I only opened the three kind of fetch cards, and it's only on one of them that it mentions you can go and get it, so it was almost like its own legend within the set for me. So it's really nice to then see that come back. And I imagine it's the same for a few people like that. Like, again, the Toshiro one's a very obvious one. The Fable of the Mirror Breaker is obviously a massive harken back to Kiki-Jiki. And I like that when you travel 12,000 years in history, you might feel like you're going to lose a lot of the things that you liked in a set. And a lot of the old players might be like, oh, we're not going to see too much of the old school, because it's kind of unlike Dominaria, where every other legend's immortal. Like, a lot of the people that we've seen and have loved and all of that nonsense are dead. You know, okay, Hidetsugu's still around, but he's, you know, a demon-fueled ogre. You know, not everyone's got that kind of longevity. So it's quite nice that there are a few throwbacks to stories and to characters that will be, like, you know, fan favourites. And I think this is the perfect kind of way to do it, you know. And again, you're not like it's not like you're rehashing. It's almost like you're reinstating the lore of Kiki-Jiki, right? It's not like, oh, it's just another version of Kiki-Jiki. It's like, no, it's that the Kiki-Jiki's influence still is on Kamigawa, you know? That's what makes it good. It's not the fact that they went, oh, what legends can we just slap into a weird, you know, Frankenstein's enchantment creature and go like, hey, here's your nostalgia kick. It's like, well, no, it's kind of, it's an homage, right? Rather than than a cheap
out. How else are they meant to do it? See, this is why this set sings. And I think on the ground, this set is actually more divisive than I think we gave it credit for. I was at our local game shop the other day, I was listening into people's conversations, you know, as you kind of do, like when you're sat in a cafe or whatever. I was on Friday. It was Friday the 18th, so obviously that was when the paper Magic is released to the world, because I tend not to I didn't go to pre-release this time around, so I didn't get any like early products. So I was getting my bundle, as I want to do, and I was kind of sitting there flicking through my cards, and there was a couple of conversations drifting through the air about people being like, oh, I really like this, really like that, but then there were other conversations being like, you know, this set really isn't for me. Like, this is the step too far in terms of its cyberpunkiness, and this is essentially just them like lubing us up for when they bring in Warhammer. Like, do you know what I mean?
Fortnite, and, you know, I liked, like that.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I liked Kaladesh and Mirrodin, but for some reason, this is just the other side of that coin, right? And that's totally fine. So I don't think this set is maybe as universally loved as we in our sphere of being on like on social media a lot and engaging with a lot of people who say like make the game or like other content creators. For some reason, there just seems to be this kind of like little dissonance there. But what I'm trying to get at is that the people who kind of naysay about this not being just old Kamigawa but a return to, is that this is how you have to do it. You do have your old characters, you do have your homages, and there's room to do that, but without just filling up the set with the same old legends again and again and again. As much as, you know, I really appreciate the fact that, say, Odrix and your Niv-Mizzets all get, like, three cards each, eventually that's going to get real tired. Like, how many versions of the same legendary can you have again and again and again, especially if you return to your fan favorite planes? And, you know, there's a whole block of Kamigawa out there for people to enjoy if they want to. We're going to do something new with it. We still want to give you your old legends. This is how you do it. And I thought, why not? It's absolutely perfect. I don't see what the big deal is, really. Yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah. Another stand up for me is The Fall of Lord Condor, because this is kind of, I think this one kind of shows more than anything, kind of almost like the beginning of the story, which is kind of it's not even necessarily at the beginning of the story, but I like the succinctness of you exile the creature with mana value 4 or greater. Obviously, that's Condor getting defeated. Each player gains control of all permanents they own. That's that which was taken being returned, you know, Kyodai kind of being freed from her prison, stolen by Condor. And then as you flip it, it flips into the fragment of Condor. And this is lovely. It says it in the flavor text here, but the story goes that after Condor was defeated, he was, you know, for his transgressions against the Kami, his immortal body was turned to stone and then shat into 1,000 still living pieces. And what I love is that this little picture of him on the reverse side, if you look on the main picture, it's a lovely stone relief. I think these stone reliefs, we've seen them all the way back since the original Triumph of Gerard, you know, like that same kind of motif and Chainer's Torment, I think, was the same kind of thing of where it's like a stone facer, right? And I think this is kind of one of the ones that kind of sings to me more, is that this idea of this is how like kind of history in England, not in just England, in on Earth kind of presents, right? Of where you do all of these like stone carvings, right? So it kind of plays to me more. And right at the bottom, you have him all kind of shrinking and kind of cowering in fear. And on the flip side, it's just got a giant crack through himself. And he's a 1/3 defender. When he dies, draw a card. I don't really care about that. But I love the fact that even the enchantment creatures are human noble. You know, I love this idea that there are still fragments of Condor out there, still alive, still in pain. Like, I know it's a bit macabre, but I mean, you know, he fucked up the entire plane, so he kind of deserves it. I just love that. I love that they lean into that. And if you know the story, it sings even more. And if not, and if you don't know the story, now you do know the story. You know, and so it doesn't take a lot.
I mean, Condor's kind of one of those interesting characters because he was one of Magic's first white aligned villains. So it was kind of like he's a real shit. He's a real shit bag. Mm-hmm. Complete imperialist. Yeah, I love it. And one of my favorite cards from the set, as obviously the Akiba Reckoner Raid is for me peak like neon dynasty, like for the new stuff. But in terms of what's blending old and new, And it's also, I think, one of the cheekiest cards in the set for a kind of reason that I don't think this is necessarily a big deal, but it's just an interesting one to me. And that's Besiegeu Reaches Skyward, or Besiegeu Reaches Skyward, art by Sezu Chen. The reason I love this card so much is not only is the flavor like pretty decent on the front side, like we were talking about how maybe it's a little bit like, you know, the flavor's maybe just a little bit broader, but actually I think this really works for Besiegeu, where the first mode is search your library for up to two basic forest cards, reveal them, put them into your hand, and then shuffle. So that's obviously the idea that, you know, the natural forces of Kamigawa are very strong and like a gathering all around. Then the second mode is put up to one target land card from your graveyard on top of your library. Again, if you're moving into more modern Kamigawa, it's the idea that Besiegeu as a tree is trying to reclaim a lot of the territory of like the modern world encroaching on it. So it's, you know, it's regrowing from the ashes of like industry destroying some of like the more natural order. And then
it's also
on the being
put on top of your library, right? So it's actually the tallest out of everything you've
yes exactly
playing.
yeah, which is beautiful. And then on the backside, it's Branch of Besiegeu, enchantment creature, plant 0/0, and then with Reach, which is just excellent for the flavor of Besiegeu being the tallest thing on Kamigawa again. And then the Branch of Besiegeu gets +1/+1 for each land you control, so the more natural order you have, the stronger it is. So it's just really sort of flavor all the way through. The flavor text is, though they razed the surrounding forests, the builders of Tawashi left Besiegeu unscathed, shaping the city around the ancient tree. And I just think as a saga, it's just incredibly solid. The other reason I think that this is one of the most solid sagas is the artwork itself. So again, by Zezu Chen, it's woodblocks. So it's Japanese woodblocks, which are Yosegi's Zakuri. I'm terrible with Japanese pronunciation, but that's the joined construction technique. But not only is it trying to represent this art style, which is like incredibly popular in Japan, but it's done in such a way that it's also sort of like 8-bit and or 16-bit, I suppose. So it looks like a tech glitch, like how you would sort of, you know, usually associate with things like cyberpunk. You see it all throughout the artist direction of this set, for example. So it's a really nice blending of traditional art styles used to mimic or ape more modern aesthetics, which is obviously what the whole deal with this set is about, which is just absolutely fucking amazing. The reason I think it's a bit cheeky, you can agree with me or disagree with me, we have a Besiegeu card in this set. Besiegeu is literally a card in this set. So the fact that they've given it its own saga is like they've gone, we love this tree so fucking much, we're going to give it two cards. Do you not think? No, yeah. Azusa doesn't get a card in this set. They get a saga.
Well, I guess the idea, right, is one, Besiegeu's still here. So it's not only, it's almost like this, not only do we get to see Besiegeu as it is, but we get to know the story of it, of how it got there. Because some people come and look at this tree and be like, cool, big tree. And they'll be like, well, big tree, and why are the roots like that? You know, like why are they? Why did it decide to? What's going on? You know, and then you go, oh yeah, this is why. And you know, the idea being that, because when I first read the story, I didn't see any visual for Besiegeu. I just assumed that it just carried on trying to grow like a normal tree, not going, I'm the tree, and then all my roots are just going to like extend like a fucking like a Garry's Mod glitch, you know? And it's just going to extend up and just go like, I'm still the tree at the top, you know? It's not a trunk anymore. It's no, the roots just decided to push me up. So I guess, you know, it's almost like you need the you don't just need the living legend, as it were. You need the story behind it as well. And I guess Besiegeu can't really tell its story because it's a tree and not a tree folk. God, imagine if you animated Besiegeu. Nyssa, never come to Kamigawa. Please.
Who would win in a fight between Vitugazi and Besiegeu?
A Besiegeu fight, 100%. Vitugazi could barely take on a single God Eternal. Besiegeu would raise Kuwashan. It would raise the entire
Get
capital.
Wrecked. Yeah. Get wrecked, Ravnica, you and your shit trees.
Yeah, no one cares about you. Spirits. You think you've got a good city? Bitch, come back when you got some neon going on. Come on. Get it together. Oh man, way to show.
All right, no, yeah, I agree. I agree.
But you know what I mean? Yeah. Well, we still get a few different mediums as well, right? Like, because we got as you said, you had the fan. We've got the handle and the katana. Azusa's Many Journeys, as you mentioned, it's her robe, because she even painted the different places she went onto on her robe. I like the idea of that as well. I mean, again,
yeah, it's a kimono. Yeah.
Yeah, the kimono, exactly. So this is my question to you, Andy. Kind of, where else now? Because there's no other sets we're going to see a 12,000 years later kind of thing of. And Kaldheim was almost like built as a as a plane of fables and stories. I don't know how late into their development and process that was kind of put in, you know, as opposed to like the 10 realms or whatever, but it kind of front faces whole storytelling, you know, Bose and Arnie and all of these people that were very much around telling the story and having the best story you could have, to, you know, taking that to your grave. Where's the next place we could see sagas? And I don't just to take the easy route and go, well, we're going back to Dominaria later in the year.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I just answered my own question as I was asking. I was like, fuck, we're going back to,
we're going
to
see them in Dominaria. It's an interesting one, right? So I'm going to show my working on this one. So if we look at all the sets that have had sagas in the past four sets, not including Modern Horizons 2, get fucked.
Because we've got to assume that's in Dominaria as well as a saga, right?
Well, yeah, of course it is. Yeah, for sure. Three out of the four have had quite real-world aping motifs, right? So obviously, you know, Theros Beyond Death is ancient Greece. Kaldheim is Norse mythology and, you know, that whole part, kind of part of the world and tradition. And then Neon Dynasty is obviously Edo-era Japan or like ancient, you know, Japan. So they can pull from the techniques and traditions of real-world societies to make the sagas more interesting. And I think we've become accustomed to that and the idea that, you know, oh, well, we want to see, like, a saga told on the side of a clay pot. Oh, we want to see, you know, some Japanese lacquer work or, like, you know, on a fan. That's really cool. That's a really cool way to do it. But if we remember all the way back in Dominaria, when we first saw the sagas, they were able to tell these stories in a kind of situation where it's a fabricated history and culture. So although something like History of Benalia, by the artist who we won't bother talking about, kind of used stained glass windows, and you had something like, you know, the Murari conjecture was like a star map and all these kinds of things. You also had Phyrexian scriptures, which was the artwork and the style of storytelling was a Phyrexian blood altar. Which, although, all right, you have to, like, pull something from somewhere. Like, you can't just make up something from nothing, like, in terms of our own real world. It's a fictionalized history, right? Mm. So you could, if they wanted to go down that route, do any plane.
Spinning tales, right? So, yeah.
It's just spinning tales. So, for example, we're going to New Capenna. Back to New Capenna. What a stupid sentence.
Let's come back to that in 2026, shall we?
Yeah, right. So we're going to New Capenna next, right? Which is 1920s US Art Deco, right? So we're talking East Coast, like Chicago and New York. And although that's about as modern... It's about as modern as we're going to get.
I'm just imagining demons with a Bronx accent, and it just made me chuckle. Of course.
Imagine the voice lines on...
It's going to be so funny.
...on Magic Arena for, like, some, like, for, you know, Obnixilus.
Yeah, he comes out, stick him up, you fools.
Yeah. You want to sleep with the fishes?
Sleep with the merfolk?
Oh, God, we need to stop. So sorry, all US listeners.
Apologies. But,
so what, I mean, there really isn't much to stop some sort of, I hope they don't, but they could do a saga where it's like a newspaper. Do you know what I mean? Or like a billboard or something similar, or like a newsreel where it's the saga of, like, you know, demon gang warfare hits the streets of New Capenna again.
My
or
God. Kind of thing as it spins towards the camera.
You can do sagas
so
anywhere.
Meta. You could definitely do that, yeah. Because we had the opportunity, right, in Eldraine, yeah? Because it was, like, tales and stuff like that. And because that's another one. But they could have, like, fables, right? Because there's the fable of the wolf and the owl from Lorwyn. And that's kind of the other thing I'm thinking, like, kids' fairy tales and stuff like that. That was an opportunity they maybe could have done in Eldraine. So if we go back to Eldraine, maybe they do that.
The reason I think they didn't do that, because you are right, you're 100% right. I think it's a very fine distinction. And I don't necessarily think this is something that is like a hard, like, this was what they carried on. But I think maybe the decision where, because this is how I see it, was that Eldraine was a world where the kind of fables, as you like, were just the world they lived in. Yeah, it wasn't the past. It wasn't theoretical. Hansel and Gretel are characters in Eldraine. The seven dwarves are real in Eldraine. Do you know what I mean? Like, they didn't need, like, sagas or story tales of them. The Kenrith and Linden are the people of legend, and they are already
there. It was only 10, 15 years ago. It's not necessarily from... Because I guess that doesn't necessarily... Because I guess we don't know when, like, the Akiba Reckoning Raid necessarily happened, but it's almost like they need to almost catch us up, I guess, with Kamigawa as well, right? It's not just, oh, this is the story now. It's like people be like, well, what happened in between? And they go, oh, okay, well, here's the Shattered States era. Here's the era of enlightenment. Here's the restoration of Iganjo, like all that kind of thing, I guess. Michiko's reign of truth.
Exactly it's why they gave us those up. Stories.
Yeah, it's almost like filling in the history, right? And this is what I mean, is because we don't have any other planes that are from back in the day, really. Like, we've done our big catch-up ones with Dominaria. We did our big catch-up one with Kamigawa. And it's now they would have to kind of push for new ground. Because I guess even with Theros, we didn't get it the first time. It didn't feel like they were missing. We got those kind of like weird, in the pre-release, it was like hero cards. There was these weird hero cards, and they had the similar thing. So I think we mentioned this when we talked about them in the Theros. So they had like almost like the same idea of like reliefs, right? Of architectural reliefs. And that was kind of where they pulled their stories from. And they probably looked at that and went, oh, there's ground here we can kind of move into. I'd be interested to see where they think they go next with it, or what they do next.
The other place that we could see this kind of stuff, and I think I'm looking like into kind of very future hypothetical territory now, is that if we were to ever go back to a plane like Ixalan, and we went to Torazon, so the vampire homeland, which is all, obviously it's based on conquistadors, like Spanish conquistadors, so the main religion there is going to be Christianity, probably specifically like Catholicism, and so you're going to have like a lot of like sort of European architecture, and you'll have things like painted ceilings, you'll have a lot of sort of like religious iconography almost, but like for the religion of the Dusk Rose. So that'll be things like, you know, paintings or tapestries or whatever, but done very much in that kind of Gothic European art style. And a lot of like cathedral architecture. Like, is it Bernini who's the one of the sort of more famous architects? I could be getting that wrong. My architecture knowledge is not the best, but you'll also get like a lot of like marble carvings and things. So that would be a really good way that if we ever went back to somewhere like Ixalan, they could have a very fabricated history, because it's not really based on, they didn't go too hard on the Spanish conquistadors. Like, it was just the armor more so than anything else, and like the religiosity. They're still vampires. So I think they played up the vampire thing maybe more so than the real world. Like, you know, these are Spanish like invaders, you know. But they can have that aesthetic to them, you know, which I think would be pretty cool.
I like this idea of a false history, like a spun story kind of thing. It's not like a true representation to us as an audience. It's almost like what's being said to the people of that plane, you know, what are the stories that they are that have circulated. I could see, for example, had they not done like a single Phyrexian scriptures one, I could have seen maybe like we're getting a bunch of sagas of the history of Phyrexia from the new Phyrexians' perspective, you know, of what do they believe their history is, and kind of maybe we'd see that. But like, it's one of these things of where I, because it's always done so well, and even now, like, I feel the swing that they did on it of, you know, flipping into creature sides and then them justifying it mechanically and flavor-wise quite nicely. I don't think any of the cards particularly egregious, you know. It shows that they don't have to, I guess, be all in. Sometimes the environment is the right space for them. And I feel like now they've done enough sagas, they will always do them justice. Because I guess, again, in the Kaldheim thing, it might have been very late into the story. They were like, well, we need some uncommon signifiers. Well, this is the story plane. We haven't fit sagas in yet. Screw it. Let's two birds, one stone. Let's do it. Every saga is multicolored, and all of them are representing like the history of each individual realm. They could probably just do that even late in the development. Go, is there space for sagas in this set? Has it been long enough since we did them? Because as you said, like, there was a good 2.5 year gap between Dominaria and Theros Beyond Death, and then we've had a set each year that's had sagas involved with. And obviously this was the MDFC year, so of course, or I guess last year was, and we get a little bit of that here of where we get MDFC sagas, which, without even really thinking about it, kind of, I didn't even notice that this was the first time we've had them do this. And I guess MDFCs are so rife now and in every set that I didn't even like blink twice about it, because of course that makes sense. And it's just, I just, again, living stories, right? Like Reki specifically wrote all of the history on himself, you know, like this is kind of the perfect platform for it, and I think it's worked really nicely. It doesn't feel too clunky. Yeah. I imagine from a gameplay point of view, it must also feel quite nice to kind of go through the motions of the story and then have this thing at the end of it. It doesn't just go to your graveyard. You've got this now thing, this story, and all the weight that you can now hit in with, and it does a thing, and it attacks, and it's got this lovely flavor text on it. It's almost like it came to a head with Kamigawa, right? Of where you have not only are we telling the stories, but we're also living the consequences of the history as well. So that's quite nice. Good job, Wizards.
It's very poignant. It's very heavy. That's like, it's a lot going on there, but I agree. I completely agree. Yeah. Cool. I mean, I think we've said all we can say about these sagas without just going around in circles and seeing how great they are. So yeah, I just keep them coming. They're always a blast. A couple of bits of housekeeping for some of the flavor that we've maybe not spoken about over the past few weeks, or maybe some things that we also got wrong. Let's start with what we've got slightly wrong. They did release side stories for Kamigawa, and one of the side stories that they released is called The Foes Who Make Us by Abby May Otis, which tells the story of Heiko and Noriko Yamazaki, who we assumed, just because of the nature of the brothers Yamazaki, were sisters. They are actually cousins, which is kind of cool. Like, I like actually not falling back on consistently having siblings as the rivals. Like, it is it's nice to have other types of like family unit represented. I don't think it's a big like whoopsie on our part. Like, the story wasn't out when we said that and we assumed a thing, but yeah, they're cousins, so I
guess it makes sense as well. I guess it makes sense, right, for cousins to have differences rather than brother and sister, right? Because that's usually like different households might have different values, so it kind of makes that makes more
they're
sense
also
anyway.
They're also like they were raised very separately as well in the story. I won't really spoil the story. Go read the story. But yeah, they're cousins. And also, I just want to flag up the utter gluttony of flavor story things that we have been given. So not only did we get the main magic story, which, you know, episodes 1 to 5, which we covered, and obviously the saga stories, which we also covered, and then the prologue to the main stories, which we covered. We also got the side stories for the Commander Deck characters and the cousins Yamazaki. We also got a manga.
Yeah, I just saw this today. I was like, when did this come out? Where did they hide this? Oh, it's beautiful.
Well, they're not hiding anywhere. It's literally on there.
No, but I know. I didn't see it. I don't know why I didn't. When did it drop? Did it drop like very, very recently?
Like a week and a half ago, as far as I'm aware.
Okay.
They also got a is it an animated comic or like,
oh,
I don't
man,
know how they're
yeah.
describing it.
The trailers are so good. This
so oh around. So no. So not the trailers. Sorry, this is like another like this is like a another story thing, but it's like an animated like comic panel thing. And then they also have the trailers for the game. So obviously when the set got sort of like teasered, you had that sort of 30 to 40 second thing where you saw the ninja with the Tanuki mask, who I'm assuming is now Kaito, although other than the Tanuki mask, it's not very Kaito-esque. And then it kind of pulls out and you see the Wanderer on the rooftops, and it's got the kind of deep synth music playing. And that was the thing. They've done an extended version of that trailer, which has Japanese voiceover on it now, so that's now like a 2 minute like thing with the Tanuki mask and the Wanderer. And then you're right, they've done a fully animated anime 3.5 minute set trailer.
The rest of my movie, Wizards? Why would you do? You clearly have the funds and the ability and the talent to be able to make this a thing.
Like, oh, you're gods. So spoiled. You're
I know,
so
but
spoiled.
it gives me
saga
so much
thing
faith
again.
No, it gives me faith for the series, because if they do this mini-series with any of the same amount of care and attention, I mean, I don't know who obviously the production studio was or anything did, I have to look it up, but because, I mean, the art style was fantastic, I guess off the back of Arcane and stuff like that, like, I guess they're trying to tap into the, okay, that we're on a futuristic steampunky anime vibe kind of thing, right? And it kind of works. And it's so good. It's really well done. The voice acting in it's great. The art style is fantastic. I didn't realize how much I needed the Wanderer. And also, it kind of plays into slightly different character notes, right? Because it plays into, it almost makes them look as if they're kind of, there's a relationship forming there, like a romantic relationship forming. Whereas I feel like in the story, it was very understated, if like not stated at all. I feel like they kind of left it open for the audience to kind of ship them or not ship them as much as they wanted
to. Yeah, I sort of
feel
like, I mean, oh no, I'm not even going to go down that well. I was about to say, like, we both watch our fair share of anime, and I tend to think that is the kind of usual trope of, like, slightly unrequited, downplayed love between a masculine and a femme protagonist in anime. But then there is so much anime out there, and people who watch way more than it than I do, that I could probably be completely wrong on that. But just from my experience of watching anime, that's usually the kind of thing. They, like, or at least in in
it's the stereotype,
short
right? form.
Yeah, it's the stereotypes, or at least in like, you know, like when they, if they do like a 3-minute trailer or like an opening credit sequence for a TV show, that's the kind of story they try and tell, whether that's actually a thing. But I think also I really like the touch of having the song that went along with the trailer is that very classic anime thing of having lyrics that almost bear no bearing
yeah,
on
absolutely.
What is actually going on. It's just
a cool song. I fight for the blinding sun that might reach your eyes, and you're like, but that has nothing to do with what's going on screen. Yeah. Bye. I also love that in the manga. I love the fact that in the manga, Jinja Taxius has these like really fancy trousers on. I feel like this is one of these big, this is the biggest thing out of this set, right? Is Jinja Taxius's dress sense. Cause he was just wearing this weird, like kind of robey thing in the original Frexia. And then he got like new threads, new ice, as it were. And it's quite nice to see everyone kind of like losing their shit over like, well, what's he going to be wearing next time?
Like, well, not only losing their shit, mate, there's like people being full on horny on main for Jin.
Thirsty
Taxius.
For Jin. Like, so I'll have a double gin. I'll have a double gin and tonic, please.
Crikey.
Thank you.
Like, people, he's a Phyrexian praetor, and also he's objectively the most terrifying looking one. In a world where you have Shieldred and Elish Norn, and Jinga Taxius is the one that people are like lusting after. I mean,
yeah,
I don't want to lust after any of them, but I'm just saying.
Like, yeah, but you can kind of almost understand the other two, right?
They're humanoids.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, it's so,
is this big metal man.
It's so funny. It's in a set where you've got the Wanderer, who's like super kawaii over here, and then you've got Best Mum Tamio, who's also now got a super sexy Borg transformation, and everyone's just thirsty for gin.
Obviously it's just the magic community just having fun with nonsense, isn't it? Which I think is, yeah, it's, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the people at Wizards of the Coast, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say they really fucking love Kamigawa.
Yeah.
With the amount of stuff we've got.
Yeah, I thought the audience response back in the day was unfair, because again, we've already talked about this when we were looking through art style and things a couple of weeks ago, where there is such a wealth and depth to Kamigawa that those that loved it really loved it. And I feel like if you're deep into the game, either game lore or gameplay, and a lot of people up in head office in Wizards will be, they'd have been around and designing and playing during this time. And again, even if you just played it within us in a limited environment, it was a really fun set to play. It just has a lot of negativity, that residual negativity, and it kind of shows that if you have enough people that really care for it, you can turn that around. Because again, as you say, there is still some discourse. I feel like there's not going to be a magic set that doesn't have some push or pull. I feel like that's just the kind of current world we live in, right? That everyone has to have the extreme like or the extreme dislike, and there's always evidence one way or another, because it's all conjecture. That as long as the people upstairs who are making it have the love and affection, you kind of it clearly manifests within the set anyway.
Love and affection and respect enough to do it right these days as well. I think that's the main thing, is like, you know, it's all, there is the discourse is often around people going, well, like, clearly they like this thing because they've paid homage to it. And it's like, yeah, but they've also just paid homage to what their pop culture understanding of the thing is. Like, there is now the level of you have love and respect for what you're doing. And then that will show through to create something that's almost perfect as a product, which I think by all accounts, and I think by a lot of understandings, Neon Dynasty is just one of the most tightly flavored sets in all aspects, and you just can't fault it. And the one last thing that I will talk about that we didn't talk about just now in terms of the things they brought out is the original soundtrack for the set.
Light
they've
up,
got a bunch of different musicians and bands to do music for Kamigawa.
It's all a
is
little.
Is this what we're going to get with every set?
Yeah, it's all a little surreal. It's kind of like when the Fortnite Secret Lair drop thing happened. I was just like, oh, is this where we are now? Like, and I'm very much not, again, I don't like fighting the verve, as it were. Like, I was very much, when I heard about the Warhammer and I heard about Street Fighter, I was like, bring it on. Why not? Let's see what we can do with it. But yeah, it's weird having a magic music video. It's almost like, I like having my geekdom compartmentalized. I don't need it exposed and open to the rest of the world for critique, you know? And I feel like that's kind of
well,
fair.
Yeah. I will say that if Wizards of the Coast want to pay musicians to write music for the game, then by all means, go for it, because someone will enjoy it. I personally have almost no interest in the original soundtrack for Kamigawa. But,
isn't
you know,
it bad?
That's
isn't
just
it bad
me.
That this is... Isn't it bad that this is almost like the opposite for the stories? Like, there are people out there going, if Wizards wants to put money into writing novels for their sets, they can, but it doesn't interest me whatsoever.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing.
Damn, that means they're kind of right, because I agree on the opposite side. Yeah, I'm like, cool, if you want to do music videos and stuff like that, like, great, cool, it's not necessary for me. There's a lot of people out there that really enjoy it, which is good. I'm glad.
Arguably, a 2-minute song is far easier to digest than, you know, like 5 hours worth of reading content. Do you know what I mean?
I've got to do reading. I can't just watch and listen. No.
Oh, I'm a terrible reader. I'm a really bad reader. I'd much like, maybe I will just listen to the soundtrack. Maybe this will become Magic the Flaming, or become a soundtrack podcast now.
That's it. Embed your magic story into a soundtrack in an audio file and you're fine. Get Stephen Fry to read your magic stories and people will buy the shit out of it.
Well, Voice of All, who's a content creator, used to do audiobooks of... But I don't
there's someone
know
else who still does
anymore.
That. No, there's someone else, but they do a reductions on it. They do like a story redux. So it won't be word for word. It'll be kind of similar to like what we do, but with a bit more expansion on it. That's something different.
Who knows?
I hope it brings it back. I guess it depends on how much novelization there is to do it with, right?
Hmm.
Good. It feels like we came to the end of the episode there. Good.
Listeners, if you want to let us know what your favourite sagas are, then please do let us know via our social media channels at mtflavoring. Emails go to mtflavoring@gmail.com. My personal Twitter is at @AndyManface. Nathan's, yours is?
At the Fox in the Moon.
We're on episode 99. One more to go. Nathan, you are off very soon on your travels around... the places that are not here. I have already started backlogging some episodes that will be coming out over the next few months. There were some pretty exciting guests coming on. It was already weird. I did a recording yesterday for an episode that will be coming out in about 3 weeks or whatever. And it was very odd, I will say, doing this exact sign-off without you there. I think I even mentioned it. I was like, I don't know how to finish this episode.
Did you say my pastor should see you soon, or did you just leave?
No,
did you leave the world hanging?
No,
they don't know when they're going to see you next. Oh God,
I didn't even just finish it with thank you so much for listening. This has been Magic the Flavoring. I didn't even do that, which would just be a fine sign off. I think I just flumped it and just went cool, bye.
see you later, I guess.
Yeah.
Great, amazing. I'm kind of excited. It's gonna be odd. I feel like when it came to interview episodes, especially doing it remotely, it's much more difficult with three people, because even now doing it, and I'm looking at you over video, it kind of helps, because we don't really talk about it in any depth. Like the 20 episodes we did in person, it kind of felt like the flow was a bit more natural. It took us a few episodes to get back into the rhythm again of doing it remotely, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe three people, it becomes a bit too chaotic, but God, yeah, it is weird. I mean, I am going to be back in the summer, so hopefully we can do like a little a season 2.5 or whatever. By then, sure. Lots of shit would have happened, I'm sure, in Magic. It always does.
Well, we will get to that when we get to that. All right.
Exactly.
All that remains for me to say is thank you so much for listening. This has been Magic the Flavoring.
We'll see you soon.
Yay! You said it.